We're meddling. It's sort of like mother-in-law, father-in-law fight. Don't get involved in the middle. You're not going to win.
Congressman Don Young votes for cutting off funding for the Libya conflict. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 24th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Unalaska responds to a tsunami warning.
With that little amount of time, I made the decision to go ahead and evacuate the community.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
An Alaska judge has ordered that failed U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller pay nearly $18,000 in legal fees incurred by the state in fighting Miller's challenge to last year's election. But Judge William Carey said Miller won't have to pay legal bills for his rival, Senator Lisa Murkowski. In the order issued today, Carey said the main thrust of Miller's challenge to the election was not, in his view, to promote and preserve constitutional protections, but rather to win. Miller sued over the state's handling of the election and counting of votes for Murkowski, who ran as a write-in after losing the GOP primary to Miller. In a surprising turn of events today, the U.S. House rejected a measure to cut off funding for the U.S. offensive in Libya. In an odd coalition, Republican leadership and liberal Democrats were pushing the effort to buck President Obama's efforts there. But despite the GOP having the majority in the House, leadership couldn't muster the votes. 89 Republicans voted against the resolution. Congressman Don Young calls that shocking. He supported it and wants to cut off funding. President Obama has pledged to do only airstrikes, but Young fears the U.S. will end up putting troops on the ground. He calls the president's decision to go in 3 months ago a bad mistake.
That's a crazy country anyway, and this is a battle about power. This is not about democracy. And I just think we're meddling. It's sort of like mother-in-law, father-in-law fight. Don't get involved in the middle. You're not going to win.
The House resolution would have cut off funding for the U.S. forces that aren't engaged in support missions for the NATO coalition. It would have severed money for drone strikes. Downtown Unalaska and Dutch Harbor emptied out after a tsunami warning triggered an evacuation of the entire community to high ground. A 7.2 earthquake east of Atka at 7:09 p.m. Thursday caused local authorities to order everyone to at least 50 feet above sea level. KUCB's Jacob Resnick reports.
The echo of tsunami sirens reverberated across town as hundreds of residents moved to higher ground. The Alaska Tsunami Center in Palmer had issued a warning for a wide swath of the Aleutians that included Atka and Unalaska. Unalaska's acting public safety director, Matt Betson, said the Tsunami Warning Center had told him a wave could hit by 8:28 p.m., and that was less than an hour away.
We didn't have time to wait for additional confirmations, and they weren't able to give us a confirmation one way or the other as to whether or not a wave had been generated until 2021, which would have been far too late.
Public safety contacted KUCB, the only broadcaster based on the island, and the radio and television station interrupted its programming.
To announce that a tsunami warning is now in effect. A magnitude 7.3 earthquake has struck near Muka Pass.
By 8:15 p.m., emergency responders had moved to high ground, where more than 1,000 people stood on hills overlooking the boat harbor, watching fishing vessels steam out for the relative safety of deep water. As residents watched with a mixture of fear and fascination, the Tsunami Center downgraded its alert. Again, Matt Betson.
6 minutes before the estimated arrival time, the Tsunami Warning Center was able to determine that a dangerous wave had not been generated and gave the all clear for the region.
Fire trucks and police vehicles drove up and down the roads telling people the danger had passed.
The tsunami warning has been canceled.
Benson said he was pleased with his department's response, as well as the orderly evacuation in which virtually everyone had sought higher ground before the wave had been projected to hit. The March earthquake in Japan had caused emergency responders to drill, and that preparation, he said, paid off.
I was concerned that we were going to be functioning at the last second trying to get people up, and we were actually in safe areas And as far as we could tell, you know, all the plants had evacuated, people had evacuated with, 5 to 6 minutes warning time before the possible wave arrival time. So it went very well.
No injuries or property damage has been reported in connection with either the earthquake or the evacuation. In Unalaska, I'm Jacob Resnick.
As the Arctic sea ice pulls back and more shipping, research, and other vessels ply the opened-up waters, the U.S. Coast Guard is trying to beef up its Arctic presence. Future plans call for a deep-water port for enforcement and rescue vessels somewhere in the Arctic, Alaska, but for now they have to rely more on aircraft. Yesterday, APRN Steve Heimel went out to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson to watch a Coast Guard flight crew and Air National Guard pararescuemen working together on a way to drop help to people in distress in the Arctic.
With the Defense Department's biennial war game training exercise, Northern Edge, winding down, a U.S. Coast Guard C-130 from Kodiak loaded up for an unusual test drop Thursday. Pilot Israel Young has skimmed the tops of waves and dropped pumps and all sorts of things to troubled vessels, but this one was a new one for him.
Oh, it's absolutely unique for me. This is the first time I've had people in my airplane with the intention of having them jump out. So this is pretty cool for us.
And the Air National Guard pararescue men likewise have not worked with Coast Guard pilots on their jumps, though the Hercules they use is pretty much the same aircraft as the Coast Guard C-130. The plane has a ramp that can be dropped down, and the pararescue men and their gear can just drop off. As Sergeant John Lane describes it, his parachute pack opens up once they jump because a part of it remains attached to the plane.
The parachute is in a deployment bag. The deployment bag is attached to the static line. So the static line and the deployment bag stay with the aircraft, and the parachute is then pulled out by the package and inflates.
The training is preparing these crews to work together for similar jump exercises next month over the Beaufort or Chukchi Seas. It's part of an ongoing effort by the Coast Guard to increase its rescue capability as more shipping and other activity comes to the Arctic. And there, Pilot Young expects to be on the flight deck again.
The plan is water. We'll have to see what Mother Nature gives us. You never know what's going to go on in the Arctic, even in July. It always brings you surprises. But as I understand it, the plan is to be doing drops over the water. They have a couple of special boat packages that they can push out, and I think that's what they'd like to do. They also have some over-ice capability, I'm pretty sure. But more than anything, we'll get the bus where it needs to go so these guys can jump out.
The plane reaches the drop zone in the Eagle River area with its hatch dropped down and everyone at the ready. There are three pararescuemen in a heavily padded four-wheeler with its own oversized parachute pack. All are attached by clips to a heavy steel cable running the length of the plane. And it all happens in a few seconds. Out goes the four-wheeler, followed immediately, one, two, three, by the pararescuemen. The tethers pop the chutes and come whipping back into the plane to be gathered up by the crew, the jumpmaster, the loadmaster. The parachutes already look tiny, far behind the plane. Below is a dropmaster in charge of a crew to bring them back to the base and then do it all over again. And then, next month, again and again in the Arctic. Young compares it to being a fireman having to always be ready. For pararescueman Lane, it's about having to be ready for anything.
The test could come in the Arctic. The test could come in combat. It could really be geographically anywhere in the world. We just want to make sure that we have the capabilities to go wherever we can go and do the best for the most amount of people.
At the flight line at Elmendorf-Richardson, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans who are convinced rhubarb can make the transformation from weed to wonder food.
Kind of like a cranberries, people making stuff out of cranberries everywhere. We're trying to build up a market.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org.
Fish and game biologists are testing for the effects of acid mine drainage from the defunct Tulsiqua mine at the headwaters of the Taku River. Meanwhile, new Owners are planning to restart the mine and say a water treatment plant will be in place this fall to begin the cleanup. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander reports.
Habitat biologist Joe Hitzelberger set the fish traps
above the mine, at the mine, and at the U.S.-Canada border.
The project is a joint effort with the British Columbia Ministry of Environment and Taku River Tlingit First Nation. It's the first metals testing on the U.S. side of the Taku, the largest salmon producer in Southeast. The fish, ranging in size from 90 to 140 millimeters, or 3.5 to 5.5 inches, have already been frozen and sent to a lab outside Alaska. Hitzelberger and Fish and Game Habitat Regional Supervisor Jackie Timothy worked on the study design. Timothy says they're sampling only Dolly Varden char because Fish and Game has substantial data on the species from other mines in the state, and they need to stick to one kind of fish since each species accumulates metals differently.
For instance, we've done the testing over at Greens Creek, and we've done it up at Fort Knox and the Red Dog Mine, so we'll be able to do comparisons for sites where we have known metal contents in Dolly Varden char.
They're primarily looking for mercury in the fish, though the old mine at the confluence of the Tulsiqua and Taku rivers has been leaching a lot of metals for more than half a century. The Tulsiqua was last mined by Cominco in the 1950s.
It won't be like it just happened. I mean, if we find an accumulation at the mine, it means it's been going on for the last 50 years.
The study, though small, will give Fish and Game a bit of a baseline before mine owner Chieftain Metals begins treating the acid drainage. The Toronto-based company acquired the Tulsiqua Chief Mine last year from bankrupt Redfern Resources. President and CEO Victor Wypriski says the treatment plant is now on site.
I trust everyone in the region understands that a real permanent solution is with a viable mine.
Earlier this month, Chieftain barged 8 of 10 loads up the Taku River before water levels dropped. Chieftain has been granted most of the permits previously issued to Redfern, including the British Columbia Mines Act permit. The company is opening an office in Atlin, B.C. Wypriski says he expects more than 10 years of mine life. The Tulsiqua property is Chieftain's core asset, according to the company's listing on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and Wypriski is bullish about it.
We would target something better than 75 million pounds of zinc production a year, 8 or 9 or 10 million pounds of lead, more than 15 million pounds of copper a year, and close to 50,000 ounces of gold and 1,000,007 ounces of silver.
He says the company's goal is to start mine construction by the middle of next year. He hopes the old Tulsiqua will be in production in mid-2014. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The annual Pride Fest parade will take place this Saturday in Anchorage. As KSKA's Len Anderson discovered, this year's participants can expect a friendlier reception than their predecessors did at the city's first Gay Pride March.
Doug Frank is this year's Pride Fest parade marshal. Instead of a new car, he's asked for an older model so he can attach his plastic pink flamingo as a hood ornament. As he anticipates Saturday morning's parade, he says, "You've got to have fun after all." That wasn't the case when Frank was one of a handful of participants in the first Gay Lesbian Anchorage Parade of July 1978.
Back then, as one person just in being interviewed said, it wasn't a celebration, it really was a statement of survival because your job and possibly even your life was at stake and possibly where you lived was at stake.
Frank points to a three-decades-old edition of Gay Alaska. On the cover, marchers are carrying a banner saying, "We're proud to be gay, but afraid of job discrimination." Frank made the banner, and he's carrying one side. But you wouldn't know who it was if he didn't identify himself.
I was working in the oil industry at the time, and I was afraid of job discrimination, and I have a bag over my head. But I look back now from this vantage point of many, many, many years, and I go, oh my word, if I saw those people walking down the street, I'd be frightened.
Frank says his vantage point came about with the discovery of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender peers, lifelong self-examination and acceptance, plus a loving and largely accepting family. That's not to say fears of discrimination were misplaced. Frank pulls out an Anchorage Daily News front page from 1986. Pictured are a group of gay pride marchers. This time, only one person is hiding his identity.
The transformation has taken place. Everyone has smiles on. This is the beginning in this era of where there is a celebration, where people are no longer afraid to come out and tell the truth.
But there could be consequences.
Raymond Jorgensen, off to the left, after this picture appeared, he went back to work, and they had a ritual at the office that you'd sign a birthday card to everyone in the office. One person, having seen this picture, wrote some very derogatory things about him being openly gay. What they decided to do is no longer have birthday cards, and they put him in a back office completely isolated and separate from everyone else.
Ironically, anti-gay situations arose that expanded the celebration into portions of the community at large. In 2001, then-Mayor George Wirch ordered an exhibit at the Lusac Library showing gay family life taken down. A court decision restored it. The censorship attempt produced considerable community reaction. Frank says that year the parade drew 2,000 to 3,000 people.
I think that it was a turning point also, in that it was not just gays and lesbians that were showing up, it was many, many allies in the community.
As Doug Frank goes through his memorabilia showing the history of Pride Fest and Anchorage's gay community, it appears when Saturday's parade begins at 11 o'clock, Frank will indeed be celebrating his personal pride, but also his pride in social advances made and those yet to be. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by North Rim Bank, taking your business to the next level. With help from North Rim Bank, spot the turns and opportunities that lie ahead for Alaska. More at northrim.com. Member FDIC. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Feit. This week on AK, rhubarb. The humble vegetable is undergoing something of a renaissance with studies on its health benefits, export possibilities, and plans for commercial production of rhubarb juice in the works. The hardy plant supplies us with juicy pie fillings and other dessert fare. Ellen Lockyer, who's a big fan of rhubarb, brings us this look at the dramatic leafy plant, which some people think will be the next big thing.
This is the story I heard. Long ago, there was no rhubarb in Alaska. A sea captain brought some back from China and planted it next to his brother's cabin in Old Knick. Many, many years later, a Matanuska colony pioneer happened upon the cabin and marveled at the size of the leaves of the then unknown to Alaska rhubarb. He took some cuttings, and the rest is history. Rhubarb is such a common plant now, one hardly notices it, but a few Alaskans are trying to change that.
This is the rhubarb patch.
Carol Kenley and Bruce Bush are both small market farmers.
2 years ago, Bruce gave me one of his plants. And I got 75 starts. That's what I planted this with, from one of his old plants. Yeah. You might want to tell her about your old
project.
Yeah,
my old plants come from Max Sherrod from the North Palmer. He was a colonist.
Now Kenley and Bush are nurturing a 175-plant rhubarb patch at Kenley's farm in Palmer. A walk between the rows of bushy plants elicits a wealth of information on the proper cutting and care of the rhubarb.
A rhubarb doesn't really like it real warm, and it'll start deteriorating and it won't grow as good. That's beautiful. This is like a number one rhubarb right here.
The two have big plans for their rhubarb. They want to start a commercial rhubarb juice production company.
And why juice would be a great idea is you would sell the big stock as your fresh market. Some could go to the chopped frozen rhubarb, but all the tiny stuff you could juice. All the stuff that's too big you could juice.
Rhubarb is a vegetable, although most of us treat it like a fruit. A marketing study by the Alaska Division of Agriculture this year reveals some juicy facts about the commercial viability of the plant. There's more than 64 varieties, for one. Sadly, the report laments, rhubarb is not a fast food. On the upside, society is changing, and the local food trend is opening new markets. The report's bottom line, though, is this succinct advice. There are not many shoppers looking for rhubarb. Ruby Hollenbeck wants to change that. She wants to put rhubarb on the nation's tables.
Yeah, Alaskans know, you know, I think all of us do. If you're old-timers, you see the rhubarb growing along so many of the houses, and people just know that it's something that we can grow and cut up and use in the winter.
She says old-timers called the plant Alaska's apple. Hollenbeck authors her all-rhubarb blog, Rhubarb or Bust, from her Delta Junction kitchen.
And the reason I'm so passionate about it is because it's limitless, as far as I can see, for feeding Alaskans. No matter if you're in a village or in the city, you can grow rhubarb. We are seriously, the last couple of years, looking at agricultural food production for our state. Rhubarb, we chuckle at it, but in fact, it's a very smart move to look at rhubarb for Alaska as a production.
The plant is easy to grow, quite prolific, has no known insect predators, and loves a chilly climate, a distinct advantage for any Alaska crop. And a bonus, moose won't touch it. Hollenbeck says rhubarb is selling out at farmers' markets outside Alaska from $5 to $8 a pound. She sees it as an export crop. And mass rhubarb production is exactly what Carol Kenley and Bruce Bush would like to do. Bush says Alaska has the available land to grow it. He's growing enough right now to supply produce wholesalers in Anchorage who have it in major supermarkets.
Kind of like a cranberries, people making stuff out of cranberries everywhere. We're trying to build up a market there. And then, well, like I say, once these markets get started or these processors, people that want this rhubarb get started, then I would fall back on just the farming end. Somebody's got to grow it. We're good at growing it, so we'd stay on the growing part.
Kenley says compared with cranberries, rhubarb has more vitamin A and K and more potassium and calcium. It's high in vitamin C, low in fat, and high in fiber. Right now, their juice production idea is in the early stages with a production facility under construction.
What we're doing right now is using mason jars.
Kind of jarring it, yeah.
And bottling it that way, and so it is straight 100% rhubarb juice.
Although it's tart to the taste, a little honey or sugar will sweeten rhubarb juice. Or add it to lemonade, like Kenley and Bush do, for a delicious summer refresher.
This is rhubarb lemonade. Oh.
With the growing eat local trend, who knows where Alaska's ubiquitous plant will flourish next. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Time now for our weekly trip around the state. We're visiting two villages known to most Alaskans as stops on the Iditarod, White Mountain and Grayling.
My name is Amy Titus, and I am from White Mountain, Alaska. There's about 209 people living here. Fishing is in full swing. Everybody's catching kings and dog salmon and humpies, and the weather hasn't been very nice lately. It's just starting to pick up, but several people have caught a king salmon, so everybody's excited about that. During the summer, when there's projects, there's more jobs available, but many people go subsistence hunting and fishing and just recreational boating. Yeah, we just got a new school. It opened last summer, so it's fairly new, and everybody's happy about that. Our old school burned down a couple of years ago, so they just completed it last year, and this is the first year that they opened for in the new one. We're not on a lake, we're on a river, and it is really beautiful right now. There's leaves on the trees, leaves on the willows, and the trees are all green, and there's a bunch of flowers, and the air smells really, really nice. A few community members did plant gardens, and the ones that did have really nice results. Even it's early, they're growing really nicely. People fly on the local airlines here, but there's also the rivers open, and if you could go to Golovin or anywhere from there And you could also go upriver to Council and then drive to Nome if you like driving.
My name is Shirley Clark, and I'm from Grayling, Alaska. We're 60 miles upriver from Holy Cross on the Yukon River. Well, right now, you know, it's really, really green. We have lots of very healthy grass. We have a new airport. We welcome any tourists. The city has 7 rooms available. The bed and breakfast has rooms. You know, not terribly fancy, but people are friendly, and they like to see a different face. The only drawback is that we do get bugs. The mosquitoes get a little thick sometimes. I guess it's been proven that 51% of the king salmon spawn in Canada, so, you know, they've been bickering over the fish for years, and they still are. Well, especially in the spring here, people do really go out and fish, and it's really a nice time. Everybody's cleaned their yards. You know, it's light all night long. No one goes to bed before 3 o'clock. It's just a fun time.
That was Amy Titus from White Mountain and Shirley Clark, the mayor of Grayling. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK on Alaska News Nightly. Tune in next week when we examine a unique slice of life on the Alaska ferry nicknamed the McTusty. This story involves both donuts and bacon, so you won't want to miss it. I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacob Resnick in Unalaska, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time! Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.